This presentation is brought to you by iAwaken.org, a not-for-profit organization. We hope you enjoy the presentation. Please observe the copyright terms to which you have agreed.
We talked last week, continuing the series on Chesed, about the fact that the Ribbono Shel Olam has been very wonderful to us in that he's made us capable of experiencing pleasure. That's number one. And even when it comes to experiencing pleasure in a matter in which we are all limited, he gave us additional opportunities to experience pleasure, because not only now can we experience our own pleasure, but he gave us the ability to share somebody else's pleasure, to have nachas from somebody else who's enjoying themselves too. And that, we discussed, was a very special chesed of the Ribbono Shel Olam in enriching our chesed, our feeling of enjoyment and of satisfaction and of fulfillment, the ability to identify with another person's having a good time. So now, not only can you enjoy all the good things that happen to you, of which there are many, but you can also enjoy all the good things that happen to other people. It's an incredible gift that the Ribbono Shel Olam has given us, which he has not given to any other Bria. Nobody else has that ability to enjoy the pleasure that somebody else is getting. And then we said he went even further and he gave us the ability, if we look around and we find that we're not having any pleasure, so that's no excuse to have a long face, because other people are having pleasure, why don't you join in? And you might say, but I'm looking around and nobody else is having any other pleasure. Well, then he gave us the ability to give other people pleasure. So now you can, not only can you experience your own pleasure and somebody else's pleasure, but if you find that other people don't have any pleasure, nor do you, you can give them pleasure and then you can enjoy their pleasure. Like telling a joke, as we said, if you want to laugh, you can't just tickle yourself, you've got to get a friend in. And you've got to tell him a joke, and then he'll laugh, and you'll laugh together with him. That's the way you laugh if you want to laugh. So if you want to have nachas, if you want to have pleasure, you can't just make pleasure for yourself, but you can give pleasure to somebody else and join in his nachas, and then you'll also have pleasure. And today we're going a step further in discussing the pleasure of giving. Last week we spoke about the pleasure that you derive through sharing the pleasure of the other human being. But this evening we're going to talk about the pleasure in the actual giving, quite apart from the effect of the giving. The fact that he happens to land up being happy as a result of the pleasure you've given him, that's something else. What we're discussing tonight is the enjoyment in the act of giving something to another person, of making another person happy. And that obviously is a very spiritual experience and a very spiritual emotion. It's always funny, people run around the world and they go to the gurus to get all sorts of spirituality, and they do all sorts of funny things, and they, even within the religious framework, there's a tremendous mesiras nefesh to try and experience spirituality. And people pack their cases and they go overseas to learn in yeshivas for years and years. They do all sorts of incredible things to try and get a bit closer to the Ribbono Shel Olam. It's not that there's anything wrong with doing that, but one can get close to him right here. You don't have to go very far. There's no closeness that you can feel more intensely to the Ribbono Shel Olam than the closeness you feel at the moment that you are being mischased, at the moment that you are doing chesed, because that's about the most godly thing that you can do. If it's a phone for somebody, ask them if it's very urgent. Richard is the phone for you. There is no feeling of godliness that is more potent than actually behaving like God. An actor was telling me the other day the extent to which he actually begins to live the part that he acts, not just on the stage, but even off the stage after a while. That if he's practicing enough and he's really into it, if he's taking the part of whoever it is, Macbeth or King Lear or whatever it is, he, during the whole run of that show, on the stage and off the stage, day and night, he is King Lear and he is Macbeth. That's all there is to it. There's no division in himself between the part that he's playing and he himself. If that's the case in ordinary little things like that, imagine what happens when you start acting God. What greater godliness can you feel? You don't feel like God, but you can certainly feel godliness. You can certainly feel, more than any other way, what godliness is all about, what spirituality is all about at the moment of acting like God. and the essence, as we've discussed in the last two shiurim, of the Ribbono Shel Olam's relationship to the world is chesed. Pouring in goodness and not expecting terribly much back in return. That's what the Ribbono Shel Olam is doing all the time, and that's about the most clear revelation that we have of what godliness is. And as we said last week, if anybody asks you, what is godliness? Or what is God? God is chesed. Godliness is chesed. That's all we really know. We don't know very much more than that. But that we know for sure. He's a being who 24 hours of every day, every moment of every minute, is busy pouring in infinite degrees of chesed into this world he created to receive this chesed constantly. That's all we know about God, really. The antithesis of chesed is taking, receiving. And just as much as giving is a spiritual experience, and one of the most spiritual experiences that there are, so taking is one of the most physical experiences that there are. It's so basic to the survival instinct. It's just pure physiology. That's what taking is. It's the same thing that drives one to eat when one's hungry. You're hungry, you eat. You take, you put into your stomach, you absorb. And that's an animal instinct. And you'll remember we've discussed in several shiurim recently the concept of turning a meal into something holy through chesed, through having people at your table, through talking to them, through giving to them. That's the only way you can make a meal human. Never mind spiritual, just human. Just to take a meal out of the animal realm into a human realm, you need to be giving at the meal. Without that, there's nothing human about eating whatever. Eating on its own is totally animal. And any form of receiving, of taking, just as much as giving is spirituality, so taking is basic physiology. It's the lowest level of operation. Not inherently bad necessarily, but it's the lowest level of operation. And might in fact be, when one talks about the Yetzirah and the Yetzirah and the Yetzirah, that might be in fact the bottom line of the Yetzirah, that drive in a human being that wants to take more. And it's the difficulty in balancing the drive to want to take and the drive to want to give that creates the problems of living. And yet, this idea creates certain inherent difficulties. So let's assume for a moment that's right. Let's oversimplify it and say that taking is animal and giving is spiritual. And giving is a function of the Yetzer HaTov, and taking is a function of the Yetzer Hara. Now the Yetzer Hara can be used positively too, there's no question. The Gemara says, if it weren't for the Yetzer Hara, you'll remember, nobody would build houses, nobody would build businesses, nobody would have relations with their wives, nobody would have children, etc., etc., etc. That's all the function of the Yetzer Hara. We're not saying that the Yetzer Hara is altogether a bad thing. But basically the desire to take, the desire to have, the desire to receive, is a function of the Yetzirah, not a function of the Yetzirah. The difficulty is two. They're just two philosophic difficulties, or shall we say one practical difficulty and one philosophic difficulty. The practical difficulty is, how then does the world operate? And the whole world is based on give and take. You give, you take, you buy, you sell, you hear, you talk, you listen. All the time we're giving and taking. So if we're going to say that giving is all very nice and spiritual and taking is all very awful and physical, what would happen if we cut taking out? The world couldn't exist. So how can we ascribe something which is so essential to the well-being of the world to the Yetzer Hara, and to something which is really negative? And the philosophic difficulty is that you can't give if nobody's going to take. It's a requirement for giving to have somebody to take. And if it's so bad to take, how can it be good to give? That would be Lifnei Iver. By giving, I'm making him take. What kind of a mitzvah is that? So on the one hand, we have the whole concept which is very clear that giving is spiritual and taking is physical. On the other hand, they seem necessary, and one can't have one without the other. And once one can't have one with the other, one can't write one off or the other off. The saving point, and therefore perhaps the most critical point in this whole discussion, is therefore the role of Hakoras HaTov. Now you remember we spoke about Hakoras HaTov about a year ago, and I defined Hakoras HaTov as the intolerable embarrassment that a spiritual person experiences when he has received more than he has given. That is Hakoras HaTov. It's a feeling of embarrassment, of intolerable embarrassment, of having received more than you're given. If a person has Hakoras HaTov, then we find an interesting thing happening. What then is the consequence of having received? So let's say I'm a man whose degree of Akharas Atzev is very sophisticated and developed. And you come along and you do a chesed with me. So now, according to our thesis, you've done something very spiritual and wonderful. And I, as the recipient of that chesed, have done something very, very low down and debased. I have received something for nothing. But if I'm a Baal HaKoros HaTov, if I have the middle of HaKoros HaTov, what's that going to do? It's simply going to be a springboard for retaliation. I'm not going to be able to tolerate being in that situation for long. And the time will come sooner or later when I'll give you back a chesed with increased intensity and increased vengeance. So what have I used the act of receiving for? I've used the act of receiving to stimulate further my need to give. So my receiving also becomes a chesed in a sense. It becomes a prerequisite to a chesed. It becomes a springboard for further chesed. It becomes a point from which to operate and a point from which to develop still further. And if I never received that chesed from you, maybe I would never have been motivated to do a chesed to you. I don't know you, never seen you. I'm walking down the street and I'm lost. I don't know where I am. And you notice that I'm lost and you come up and you say, can I help you? That's the way. Get into my car, I'll give you a lift. A stranger from nowhere. That makes me say, what's your name? Where do you come from? It makes me make a mental or a physical note of it, in fact. It makes me write a letter thereafter or keep an eye open for you next time. And the time will come when I will respond. Whereas if I never received that HaKoros HaTov, when I would meet you the next time, there would be nothing to respond to, so I wouldn't necessarily do the chesed. So you can have a situation where receiving is the greatest stimulant for giving back. Therefore forgiving, provided there is the middle of HaKoros HaTov. And I think that that's pshat in an incredible thing that I noticed today. We say a bracha of La Tzok B'Divrei Torah. And the Chazal talk about it, and the Balei Musa talk about it. Why does it use the word La Tzok? La Tzok means to deal in Torah. We say that bracha every morning. And they talk about having to learn like one is in one's business. One has to plan the way one plans in a business and think about it and operate with the same involvement that one is in one's business. Learning is not just something one does in one's spare time, but it's an ethic, it's one's business. My business is learning. That's la'asek b'divrei Torah. There are very few things with which this verb la'asek is used. It's used with business and it's used with Torah. But it's used with something else right throughout Shas, all over the place. The Gemara in Brochus, that the Ribbono Shel Olam loves a person who is oisek b'toira u'vigmilus chasodim, and is mispalel l'davens in the tzibur, with the tzibur. Oisek, again, the concept of chesed, the word esek is used. There's the story in Avodah Zarah with Rabbi Hananya ben Tradyun and his friend were being led off to be killed, and by the Romans. And Rabbi Hananya ben Tradyun says, "You're lucky. You were oisek b'toira and gmilus chasodim. You learned Torah and gmilus chasodim, and I only learned Torah." So you might get off, I won't. Over and over again, many times we find oisek being used, the concept of doing business with, of dealing in, not only in Torah, but also in gemilus chasodim. No other midas. It doesn't say oisek b'tzedokah. And it doesn't say, oisek and all the other good midas that there are, or bad midas for that matter. Maybe odd ones, but gemilus chasodim, right over and over again. Oisek b'Torah v'gmilus chasodim. What does it mean, oisek? When it comes to Talmud Torah, to learning Torah, I understand the application of the word esek. You've got to make it your business. But what does it mean by chesed? And I think that it means the point that we've just made. What's the essence of business? The essence of business is profit. You invest money because you want more money back. And what are you going to do with the more money that comes back? You're going to invest it again so that still more money will come back. And when still more money comes back, you'll invest it again and still more money will come back. Like we have with Yitzchak in the parasha today. That he plants his wheat or whatever it is, and it comes up, Meir showed him 100 times more than he expected. And what did he do with that? Obviously he planted it, and it came out 10,000 times or whatever the geometrical progression is. More than he expected, until the point that he had this tremendous wealth which started arousing the jealousy of the Plishtim, as you remember. That it's investment for reinvestment and building and building and building. But it all has to stop. What would happen if you plant your first wheat and nothing comes back? Then your business is over. You can close down. You have to start again. That's the end of that transaction. The only way that the dynamics of business can continue is if profits keep on coming back. If you keep getting back more than you put in, then the business can continue. You can carry on putting in still more and getting back still more, and so it builds and it builds and it builds. When we talk about esek, both in the case of Talmud Torah and in the case of Gemilus Chasodim, which is what we're really discussing this evening, that's what it means. Part of the purpose of Gemilus Chasodim is you invest a certain amount of chesed because you want returns. It's not just that you're putting in chesed. It's not that you want returns for any kind of selfish reasons. You say doing something because you want to be written up in the paper. Not that kind of return. That wouldn't be a godly kind of chesed. You're doing it, you want some kind of response which will stimulate you to give still more back. And then you have a whole dynamic setting in, which the Gemara calls Marbeh Sholom B'Yisrael. That's how one increases the intensity and the degree of peace and of friendship among Yisrael. And that's why the din is, which I've quoted many times, that if one does a chesed quietly, tzedakah, it's very nice to do quietly. People shouldn't know about it because it's embarrassing. But chesed should not be quietly. Chesed, if you've done a person a chesed, it's good that he knows you did it. Otherwise, he doesn't have a chance to respond, and the chesed dies there. That's the end of the transaction. Whereas if he knows that you did it, he has a chance to respond, which will make you respond again, because how's it going to work? We're working now with people of Akoros HaTzoy. So I do a chesed, let's say, that's worth 100. This man feels embarrassed. Right? He experiences the emotion of intolerable embarrassment of a spiritual person at having received more than he's given. So he gives back. But being a spiritual person, he's not going to give back 100. He's going to try and give back 120. Now I'm in trouble. I only gave 100 and I've got back 120. Now I'm embarrassed. So I'm not just going to give back 20. I'll give back 50. And so it goes. Now he's got that 50. What for? The whole deal was over as far as he's concerned. It requires that he's got to do something back. And so you've got two people all of a sudden operating and building up a relationship of intense love. Proper ahava. It's amazing how the parent-child relationship in the animal world ceases immediately after the physiological functions are over. When the baby can walk and the baby can eat and the mother stops feeding, the relationship is over. There is no connection whatever between child and parents. And in the human world, it's not like that at all. The relationship goes on for a long, long time. It goes on throughout the lifetime of the two parties. And the reason for that love is not just because it's implanted naturally in the human being more than in an animal. It's not a physical emotion. If love, if parent-child love, I'm talking specifically of the love of a parent to its child, if that love were physiological, if that love were physical and material and basic to the animal world, animals would have it too. So it's not. It means it's spiritual. Now spiritually we don't get many things for nothing. Spiritual things come to us through work and effort. And the love of a parent for its child is a consequence of the extent to which the parent has worked for the child and put into the child and fed the child and sat up at night for the child and slaved and worked for the child to educate the child and so on and so on and so on. That's what really creates that love. And the love of a parent to a child is much greater than the love of a child to a parent for that very same reason. The parent loves through having given. And here you have two people, both with strong Hakoros HaTov elements, who can't tolerate having received more than they're given, so they keep on giving to one another in ever-increasing levels, creating a relationship not just of friendship, but a relationship of love. And that's really the way people are meant to operate. And it's a way which is very essential to human behavior. You remember those of you in the Ksubas Shir from the Gemara there that we find that Tosfos points out and proves that the punishment of whipping a person is not as drastic as the punishment of excommunicating him. Isolating a person from his society causes far more pain to an individual than whipping him. That's something we need. We need other people. We need other people not because they give to us. We can manage without that. One can be rich and one can have security and one can be set up in a way where you don't need people to give to you. But you do need people to give to. That, without that, one cannot live. And that's how one builds up these relationships. So here, through Hakoros HaTov, one finds that the acceptance of chesed is in itself the springboard for the giving of still greater chesed. A man who doesn't know how to accept chesed will never find himself in a position of giving chesed, of projecting chesed, or not in a dynamic situation of giving chesed. The one leads to the other continuously. How does it work in a business situation? If the whole business of living is giving, and taking is only a means of giving, how does it work when one's working? Obviously one works because one needs money. If one didn't need a living, one wouldn't work. So there we've already got a problem. So you're working in order to receive. Nevertheless, their attitudes to work and their attitudes to work, their attitudes to business and their attitudes to business. The Gemara is in the Medrash that says on the Tosuk in Nach that Chanoich walks together with the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the Medrash says on that that Chanoich was a shoemaker. Tofer min alim hoyo. And with every stitch, b'chol tefilo tefilo, with every stitch that he put into those shoes, he used to have tremendous intentions for the Ribbono Shel Olam. And the Rebbe always used to say in the name of Rabbi Yisrael Salanta that that doesn't mean that he used to sit there while he was stitching his shoes thinking all sorts of holy, godly thoughts. Because said Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, that would have been against the deen. If a man has hired you to fix his shoes, you don't have the right while you're busy fixing your shoes to be thinking about your Gemara. If you're fixing your shoes, that's what you've got to be doing with all your intent, with all your attention. Hayom Yachid Yechudim, says Rabbi Yisrael Salanta, means that with every stitch he put into those shoes, he questioned himself whether he's being yotze the halachas correctly, whether he's giving of his best ability, whether he's sure that that stitch will last, that that stitch is not going to come undone, that the person will find the shoes comfortable to wear because that's what he's being paid for. And if chas v'sholem in one stitch there's a flaw which is going to cause the person suffering, either because the shoe comes apart or because it's uncomfortable, then he's taking more than he's giving. He's being paid to make a comfortable pair of shoes and he's producing a pair of shoes which are not comfortable. That's what miyached yichudim says. So although it's true that Chanoich certainly only worked because he needed the money, once he's working, he operates on the basis, right, I need the money, but I've got to be sure that what I give in return for the money is worth more than the money I get. Or at least as much as the money I get. Like the famous stories of the Chofetz Chaim. The Chofetz Chaim also used to work for a living. And he started off with a bakery. And it soon got around that if you go and you buy by the Chofetz Chaim's bakery, you get, when you buy a kilo of something, you get a little bit more than a kilo. And the challahs are a little bit bigger than most people's challahs and they taste much better. And he got a name of being a particularly good baker very quickly and an honest man. And so he found that he was being invaded by the crowds. He couldn't handle the business. Which didn't really worry him very much, but what did worry him was the competitors. It's not fair. People are coming to him, to me, because I'm the Chofetz Chaim. That's not what I'm selling. I'm selling bread. My bread's the same as anybody else's bread. So they're coming to me because I'm the Chofetz Chaim. That's not fair to the competition. So he started working fewer and fewer hours a day until he was only open for an hour or two every day. That was all. Until he had enough for that day, and he used to close the shop and he used to go home to give the other bakers a chance. And even that didn't work, so everybody used to come in those 2 hours. Anybody who wanted to buy bread used to be there for those 2 hours. So he closed the shop. He felt that wasn't fair business. And he found other ways of earning a living. It's possible, although one's basic motivation to work is because one needs a living, it's possible to ensure that in one's work one makes sure that one is giving at least as good as value, at least as good a value as what is being paid to one at that particular time. And that's not always easy, because that's not business. Business is just the opposite. Business really is that if you're selling me a building, for example, and the building is worth R1 million, what does that mean, the business, the building is worth R1 million? That means it can be sold for R1 million. Now what kind of a chochem will I be if I buy it from you for R1 million and I sell it to somebody else for R1 million? That's not business. That's just busyness. I'm buying, I'm selling, I'm very busy all the time, but I'm not making any money. There's no point in that. So obviously what I've got to do is I've got to persuade you, the seller, that the building is not worth R1 million. It's really only worth R900,000. you know, political position is unstable. In another country, it would be worth a lot of money, of course, but in this country, you know, you've got to understand. And while things aren't too bad at the moment, you never know what's around the corner, and I hear that the gold price is not going to pick up for a long time, and, you know, 900,000, and you finally persuade the guy, 900,000. Now you've got the building. Somebody wants to buy it. Now your job is to persuade him that the building is not worth a million. It's worth it. 1,100,000. You know, things in South Africa are not what they were 3 or 4 years ago. Property is going up, and the story changes, and you've now got to persuade the buyer the same day that the same building is worth more for the opposite reasons than you just explained to the seller. And then when you finally do the deal and you've sold it for 1,100,000, you've called yourself a very good businessman. In one day, you bought something for 900,000 and you sold it for 200,000 profit. That's business. Beautiful. What have you done? Your business is based on ensuring that what you buy is worth more than what you paid for, what you paid for it, and that what you sell is worth less than what you got for it. What more dishonest system of living is there than that? But that is the business of speculation. That is the business of buying and selling, the way people normally operate. Beat the seller down and beat the buyer up to make sure that you get a bargain when you sell and you get a bargain when you get a bargain when you buy, and that the buyer doesn't get a bargain when you sell. That's business. That's no good. That's not business in the Jewish sense. In the Jewish sense, the Gemara says in Brachos Daf Ches, Om Rabbi Chiya Bar Ami Mashmei De'ula, Godol Hanene Miyegia Kapoy Yoytze Miyorei Shemai. A man who works or who eats benefits from the sweat, from the toil of his own hands, is greater than the Yorei Shemayim. He's on a greater spiritual level. And I've always been a little worried about the choice of words, Yagia Kapov. It sounds almost like a socialist slogan, Chas v'Shalom. You know, it's the laborer, the man who works with his own hands, who actually is the one to be, that's the ultimate, greater than Yorei Shemayim. And yet when one understands business and Jewish business, one understands exactly what the Gemara is saying. It doesn't mean that you've got to be a laborer digging holes in the street. It doesn't mean that necessarily. What it means is very simple. There's a certain amount of commodity in the world. And really there's no way that anybody is going to make a living by buying from Reuven and selling to Shimon. That's not going to make them. The same stuff is just going round and around and around. You know, there's the famous story of Reuven who bought a shipload of sardines and he sold them to a company in Switzerland who bought them, and because of currency fluctuations was able to sell them to a company in Pakistan at a profit. And the company in Pakistan, because they could get a lower shipping rate from Switzerland to New York, instead of bringing it to Pakistan, shipped it to New York. And the trading company in New York that got the shipload of sardines finally figured out that the price of sardines had gone up in South America so much that the extra freight to South America could still be compensated by the high price of sardines there. So they shipped it off to South America, by which time there was a terrible shortage in London, and people realized that already half of that shipload could go off to London and they could make still more money. So half of the shipload goes off to London and it's distributed into the various supermarkets, and eventually innocent housewife goes into a Pick and Pay in London, if they have such things, and she buys a can of sardines and she brings it home for her family for supper that night. They open the sardines and it's all rotten. So she goes back to the Pick and Pay place. The girl at the counter calls the manager, and the manager takes it back and gives it to the managing director of Pick and Pay. And he gives it to his shipping department to find out where it comes from. It came from a trading company in London, and the trading company in London sends it back to South America. And the guy in South America sends it back to New York, and the guy in New York sends it back to Pakistan, and the guy in Pakistan sends it back to Zurich, and in Zurich they send it back to Reuven, and they say, Reuven, what you sold me, the thing is rotten. And he says, you shlemiel, who opened it up? Sardines aren't for eating, they're for buying and selling. And it doesn't really work like that, because if you're selling and buying and selling the same tin of sardines, it really has one value. Okay, shortages here and there and this and that and the other, but basically if the whole world was busy buying and selling each other's things, we would just have a nice merry-go-round of things going round and round and round, and nobody should really make any money that way. But how does one make money from Yagia Kappa? you take the sardines and you can them. So you're making the money for canning them, not for the sardines. You bought the sardines for 100 rand, and the cans you bought for 10 rand, 110 rand it cost you, and for your labor you charge 10 rand for putting them in the can, so you sell it for 120 rand. That's the only real legitimate Torah profit. I'm not talking about freak situations of speculation. But real legitimate Torah profit is when you take a commodity for which you paid a fair and good price, and you're able to sell it for a better price, not because markets have changed, and not because you bought a shlumil who doesn't understand its value, you found a shlumil who doesn't understand its value, but you're able to charge more because of your gia kapecho, you put more into it. So at the end of the day, the only thing on which you can really make a living is your labor. Because everything else you should sell at the same price you bought it. It's dishonest to buy something at one price and sell the same object to somebody else at another price if you haven't labored with it. The labor doesn't have to be packing. It can be some other form of improvement. It can be warehousing and stocking so that the little retailer doesn't have to carry a huge stock. He can just buy from you as he needs. So you charge him for the labor of stocking. It can be the business of transporting. You charge him for the fact that it's where he wants it, when he wants it. You can charge him for the foresight possibly of having bought it when there was plenty and held on to it until there was a shortage, or whatever it is. But at each stage you've got to understand that the commodity you're selling for the same price at which you bought it. You don't have a right to make a racket on the commodity which has a price. The honest labor and the honest income is from Yegia Kapecha. You've got to take that and do something with it. Offer a service for which you're being paid. That's at the end of the day what we're being paid for. And whether we're in the professions or we're in the business, it makes no difference. What we're being paid for at the end of the day is the work involved. The din is, for example, that you're not allowed to charge for water. You're not allowed to charge a person for water. The same as you're not allowed to charge a person for oxygen. But you are allowed to charge him for the effort of bringing the water to your house. That's it. You can go to the Vaal Dam and you can take as much water as you want, and the municipality won't charge you for that. They're not charging you for the water. They're charging you for the service of purifying the water and bringing it to your house. Transport they're charging you, not water. You're not paying for the water. And that's how it has to be with everything. You don't pay more for the commodity just because it happens to have changed hands. You pay for an extra service which has been given to you. And that's the Yegia Kapecha. When a man starts viewing business that way, it starts changing. Because now, I'm a middleman, so a supplier comes to me and he says, I would like to sell you a crate of sardines. The first line of business, I should say, how much do you want for the crate of sardines? And he says, I want 100 rand. And I should say, whether I know anything about sardines and their price or not, I should say, 100 rand, the sugar. And then I judge by his reaction, and if he just walks off, then I know that I was the sugar and it was a bad gamble. But the chances are that he's not so simple, and when he asked 100 rand, he knew I would say Meshuggah. So he says, no, what would you say then? Now I don't know anything about sardines and what they're worth, but I try 50 rand. I know that's Meshuggah. He says, you Meshuggah. Alright. 50 rand. Maybe a little bit more than that. Come, let's talk reasonable. What do you think it should be? Alright. 75 rand, 60 rand, whatever it is, and the deal's done. And then I take my packet of sardines and I go to somebody else and I say, I want to sell you sardines. He says, how much? I say, 200 rand. He says, 200 rand, the sugar. And the same thing goes on. And I persuade him that it's worth 200 rand. So what have I done? By cheating the supplier, by beating him down, and by beating down the buyer, I've made a profit. That's called crooking in Torah language. And in non-Torah language, it's called business. That's what it is. In the one system, it's dishonest. And it's theft, and in the other system it's honest. You have the Torah man. How does the Torah man operate? You want to sell me a crate of sardines. He starts thinking immediately, what am I going to do with the sardines? Just take the sardines and find the shlumil who doesn't know what they're worth? That I can't do. So he starts thinking, sardines. I can repack them. I can make them look more attractive. I can break them up into smaller cans so that people who can't afford the big cans will get the smaller cans. I can schlep them from this place where there are plenty of sardines to that place where there are not plenty of sardines and make some money on the transport. That's really what I'm doing, on having them at the right place at the right time. So then I say to my supplier, sardines, very good. Now, let's go back to the first businessman a moment. He's got to also, apart from saying you're meshuggah when the price of 100 rand is mentioned, he's got to take a look at the sardines and lift it up and say, you call these sardines? What kind of sardines? This is what you're selling. I don't want this. And that's how the business thing has to start. And he's going to say, you know, but for the price it's not so bad. And then the discussion goes. The Torah businessman is the other way around. Sardines, these are lovely sardines. How much do you want for them? You want 100 rand? Let me just check up that that's what they're worth. Make inquiries? Yeah, 100 rand is more or less what they're worth. Right, 100 rand it is. I don't plan to make my money by having got them as a mitzvah. That's not how I plan to make my money. I plan to make my money through Yagia Kapecha. Through buying them at a good and fair price, providing a service for which I charge a good and fair price, and selling them at a profit in that particular kind of a way. And the whole relationship changes. What's all this got to do with chesed? One of the most important elements in functioning in business, the non-Torah way, is devaluing or revaluing. You've got to devalue the object when you're buying it, and you've got to upvalue it when you're selling it. When you buy it, you've got to look with a wrinkle in your nose and say that it's rubbish. And when you're selling, you've got to look with pride and say how beautiful it is. That's the basis of it. And one day you should try, by the way, when you trade in a car or sell it, go back to the same salesman that bought your car and try and buy it from them. And if he doesn't remember you, or send somebody else to do it with a little tape recorder. It's interesting how the story is very different. The same things which were chisroinus when you sold it, all of a sudden are marvelous now. It doesn't have a radio, but who wants a radio? And you know, it's a little bit old, but then it's not bad on petrol. And so it goes on. The biggest danger in the trading of chesed, because that's what we started talking about, doing business in chesed. I give you chesed worth 100 and you give me back chesed worth 120 and I give you back chesed worth 150 and so it goes on. The biggest danger is either a person who has no hakaras hatov, which is rare. Let's talk about a person who has no hakaras hatov. That means he feels no embarrassment whatever at receiving. Right? That's a person who is spoiled in the extreme. Totally 100% spoiled. He believes it is his right to receive. And he doesn't feel any embarrassment no matter how much you give him. The more you give him, the more comfortable he feels, and the more he feels he is getting what is his right and what belongs to him. And there's no discomfort at all. Such a human being is one danger to the whole dynamics of doing business in chesed. Because what happens? I give him a chesed worth 100 and nothing comes back. So I try to give him a chesed worth 200 and nothing comes back. And then I give him a chesed worth 500 and nothing comes back. Eventually I give up. Close the deal. That's it. You just can't go on after a while with no feedback. One just doesn't understand what's happening and one moves on to another business. There's a more prevalent danger. Not quite as serious, but more prevalent. That is, most people have some degree of hakaras hatov. Nobody likes getting for nothing, absolutely. But what people like is good business. They like getting mitzvahs. They understand that you have to pay for what you get. They understand that you have to respond for what you get. But they like to respond on the cheap. They like to give back less than they receive. That's all. How do they do it? They do it by the same system as the businessman. They do it by the system of devaluation. That's all. You know, I don't owe my parents that much. What do you think? They did it for me? They did it because they wanted children. If they wanted children, it's their jolly business to raise their children. I have to go and say thank you to them. Their business, a little thank you, give them a present on their wedding anniversary, and that's it. We devalue the chesed. We turn our nose up at the sardines. Not really worth that much. And that entitles us to get a mitzvah. So we only have to pay back a little bit and we get a lot. And soon we start convincing ourselves and we start believing that the sardines are not that good to start with. And that justifies totally the need or the lack of a need to respond in any kind of meaningful or significant way. And that perhaps is where the ethic, where the business of chesed hits most of its stumbling blocks, and where you'll find over and over again where people are having differences of opinion, where people are having personal arguments, you will always find, or very often find, that the two parties each believe that they have done more for one another than the other believes, and that they've received less from one another. It's part of the business deal. It's part of the way people deal with each other. That I, as a seller, must convince you that what I'm doing for you is worth more than you can possibly imagine, and you have to convince me, or at least yourself, that what I'm giving you is really not that much after all, and it shouldn't be over exaggerated. And there you have a situation of diminishment. So then I give you 100, and you say to yourself, well, you know, it's not worth 100. Very nice, it's worth 10. So no, worth 10, I'll give him back 12. That's certainly, I'm giving back more. I'm a balak or a satoev. I don't like getting anything for nothing. So if he's given me something worth 10, I'll give, 15 I'll give him back. I think that what I've given is worth not 100, but 150. And I've got back 15. That's a ratio of 1 to 10, so I'll give you back 1.5. I don't want to feel, or I'll assume that the 15 you gave me is in fact worth 1.5. No, here again, I don't want to be a taker. The man has given me something that's worth 1.5, I'm not going to take it. I've got to respond. I'll give him something for 2. Fantastic. What I consider is worth 2, my friend considers is worth 1.5. He doesn't want to be a taker, so he'll give something back. It'll be worth 1. And so you have the opposite of the whole system. People interrelating with each other on an ever-decreasing level of meaningfulness and intensity. Constantly devaluing the role that each other plays, constantly devaluing the contribution that each one makes, constantly convincing themselves that they're giving back more than they're receiving and feeling good about it. It's good business. So if you add up what they're receiving from each other, they're doing quite well, or one of them is doing quite well. It's good business, but it's not good terms. That's not called Esek Bigmilus Chasodim. Esek Bigmilus Chasodim is when you build it up. When I give you 100 and I think, you know, it's worth 100, I the giver. You, with your Akoros HaTov, think, you know, worth 100, maybe it's worth 120, and I give back 150. I give back 150 and think, maybe it's worth 300, not 150, I better give back 400. And so the relationship develops and so it builds. A completely different system, a completely opposite system. And a system which leads to being marbe sholem, to increasing the intensity and the quantity of sholem, of relationships of shleimus among people. There's a beautiful medrash. Alexandrus Mukden, this is a medrash in Noach, Parshas Noach, Parshas Lamed Gimel. Alexander Mukden, Alexander the Great, Ozal Legabi Malko Katsia, Lachore Hare Cheshach. Alexander the Great used to go and visit kings at the end of the world, over the dark mountains, over the distant mountains. Basholachlein, when he conquered a particular country, he sent for the king. Nofakle, so the king came to meet Alexander the Great. Vuhu toin gidumi de dahav begu daskus de dahav. And he was carrying an ornament which actually was cut, formed in the form of bread on a beautiful dish, and it was really all made from gold. Gold bread and a gold dish. And he was bringing this as a gift to Alexander the Great. Amale, the Mamoincha and Atzorich, says Alexander the Great, you think I came here because I'm short of money? You have to come and give me gold? That's what I came here for. So the king of that country said to Alexander the Great, well, if you didn't come for money, what did you come for? Food? You want real bread? Are you short of food in your country there in Greece where you come from? That's not what I came for. I've come to study. I've come to make a study of your legal system. That's what I'm interested in. I don't need your money and I don't need anything. I want to know how you operate your legal system. Joseph Gabe, so the king said, come to court tomorrow and see. You'll watch the system. So one day they were sitting in court. A man came to court with a taina against his friend. Two men with an argument, as usually happens in courtrooms. Omar Hadein Gavre Zovenli Chado Kilkalta. This man sold me a broken down ruin of a building. The Ashkechis begavah simta, and as I was demolishing the building and clearing up the rubble, I found a treasure. How the Zavin Omar Kilkalta Zavnis, seem to lose others. The buyer says, excuse me, he says, I bought a rune. I didn't buy treasure. The treasure belongs to you, the seller. Baharu de Zovan, and the man who sold, Omakil Kazu Mazda Begava Zavnis, when I sold it to you, I sold you the whole thing, footstool. Is that what they say? Just take as it is. You saw it, you examined it, and you bought it, and I had the intention of selling you everything that's in it. That was the argument, and there was no way they could reach compromise. The seller insisted that the treasure belonged to the buyer, and the buyer insisted that the treasure belonged to the seller, some place. What do you think the din should be? What do you say the din should be? The achloket should be, we have a din in Bava Metzia, that the first Mishnah that every cheder boy knows, that if you find the talis, that it's two people find a piece of cloth, a garment, and each one claims that they found it simultaneously, and that therefore it belongs to them, the finder, the din is achloket. Either achloket or called darlin gvar, the possibility of another psak, but basically it's one of finding some kind of compromise there. So this isn't a very difficult din. So you get the two together and you say, look here, we hear what each of you are saying. We're afraid you're going to have to share the treasure. That's what we would have to say. But not this king over there. Omar l'chad minayu said to one of them, Itlach bar d'cha, do you by any chance have a male child, a son? Omar l'hini said, yes. And he said to the other one, Itlach brota nukva, do you by any chance have a daughter? Omalehini said, yes, by chance, I do have a daughter. Omale, so the judge said, Zil asiv dain ledain, make a shidduch, let the son and the daughter get married, v'havi mamoini letavayun, and give the money to the young couple. So neither of you will have the money, and you'll both have given the money, and you'll both have the money, and it stays in the family, and there's no shayla, everything's beautiful. Chamte Yosef Tamei looked around, and Alexander the Great's bottom jaw fell out of his mouth, and he was just staring at this, he couldn't believe it. Omer Emalo Dain's Tav, so the king was afraid, he saw Alexander the Great, his new balabos, looking so distracted and so amazed. He said, didn't I judge correctly? Did I make a mistake? Omer Le'ini says, no, you judged very well. Omer Le'ilu have a gabchon, hech have you done it? If such a case came before you, what would you have done if you looked so amazed? Omer Le'ini says, katlin dein v'dein, and ma'asutu nasta mamoinu de tavayin. We would have killed both of them, and the government would have taken both of them. You don't want it. We would, there's such a thing of two people fighting over a treasure, and nobody wants it. With income tax, receive a revenue, we'll take it. We're not shy. Now look at his reaction. Omalei says to them, "It gabchon matanachis." He says, "In this distant country of yours, does it by any chance rain there sometimes?" Omalei says, "Yes, it rains." Omalei, "It gabchon shimshudanach." Do you have the sun? Does the sun shine in your country? Omalei says, "Yes, the sun shines." Omalei, "It gabchon beizdekik." Do you have little animals running around? What kind of, he's just trying to picture the country. What kind of place it is? Do you have animals running around, grazing in the fields? Omalei said, "Yes, yes." Omalei, "Tipach ruche dahu gavra." This man should be ashamed of himself, he says to Alexander the Great. Loi bizchuschoy nachis noto. You should know that the rain doesn't come down in your merit. The lo bizchutchun shimshe denacha aleichun. And the sun that shines upon you is not in your merit. Ela b'schuta de be'ira, it's in the merit of the animals, just so that the poor animals shouldn't die. That's why the Ribbono Shel Olam brings sun and rain to your country. Dichtiv, as it says, Odom u'vehema tushia Hashem, God will save man and cattle. Odom b'schus behema tushia Hashem. Sometimes it happens that God saves man because of the cattle. They have no right themselves to be saved, but just because of the animals he'll save them. Says this king to Alexander the Great, don't think that God treats your country so well because you're great people. You're rotters. It's the animals there that have saved your whole country. Be that as it may, why doesn't the king, and the Gemara, the Chazal seem to approve of the king's judgment very heartily. Why doesn't he just judge? You divide it. You see, if two people are arguing, each one says it belongs to me, then it is a valid compromise to say share it, because each one is getting something of what he claimed. But if each one says, I want to give it, it's not mine, I want it out of my property, then it's not a compromise to say take half. It's still against what he's claiming. He's not getting anything of what he's claiming. He wants it gone altogether. And giving him a portion of it doesn't mean that he's giving away a portion. He's not worried about giving away a portion. He doesn't want any of it. He believes it's a gazela. He believes it's theft. And if you give him one penny of it, it's still theft. He doesn't want it. That's the difference when somebody's arguing about taking and somebody's arguing about giving. You can't use the din of yachloku, you can't use the din of division when you don't want to take, when you want to give. And that really is the basis of the kind of business deal that we've been talking about. That there are times when business thrives only when it grows. Not there are times, that's the way it thrives. And the business of chesed, when the Gemara talks about being oisek b'gmilus chasodim, of dealing, doing business in chesed, that's the way it has to operate. And the only way it can operate in that particular fashion is through the principle of hakoras hatov, that an individual has to feel intolerably embarrassed at receiving more than he's giving, whether it's in his work, or in his family situation, or in a friendship situation, whatever situation it is. A husband must feel intolerably embarrassed to receive from his wife more than he gives to her. And a wife must feel intolerably embarrassed to receive from her husband more than she gives to him. And so with parents and children, and so with business partners, and with people dealing with one another in business. And in every type of transaction, in every form of situation, that is the basis of Torah ethics. To ensure that at all times, what you're giving is worth at least as much, if not more than what you're taking. And if you're making an estimate, the same as when you're trying to figure out, you're choosing a Kiddush cup and you're trying to figure out whether it's 86 cc's or it isn't, if it's just on the borderline, you're not altogether happy. So you'd rather take one that's 96 cc's. So when you're busy figuring these things out, don't be mean. When you're trying to calculate what the other person has given to you, if you're not sure if it's worth 100 or 110, don't decide, well then it must be worth 90. If you're not sure whether it's worth 100 or 110, assume that it's worth 120 and you'll be safe. We're dealing with important things. We're dealing with things where the shiur, where the measurement is vital. If your kiddush cup is too small, it's serious. You haven't made kiddush properly. But you haven't killed anybody in the process. You haven't damaged anybody in the process. It's your business. You didn't make kiddush properly. The world is not that worse off. It's not right and it's not good, and that's not the way to make kiddush. You should be sure that your kiddush cup is the right size. If your matzah is too small on Pesach, it's serious. You're eating too little matzah. It's a question as to whether you've been yotzei the mitzvah of matzah. But nobody gets hurt. It's not the end of the world. It can be repaired. It can be rectified. One can do tshuva. One can fix it. But when you're estimating what something you've received is worth, you're dealing with something that's critical. You're dealing with relationships that might not be able to be repaired. You're dealing with problems of geneva, problems of theft, of taking something which isn't yours. You're dealing with problems of akoras atzov, of not responding satisfactorily to encourage sholem. And not only not encouraging sholem, one can result in causing faribul and dispute among people. There one has to be very, very machmir. And it's something that I can never understand, how people understand the importance of being machmir in all the less important things, not chas v'sholom unimportant, but less important things. And when it comes to the very important things, people tend to be very makir. When they're measuring, making measurements, they take the lighter views very easily when it comes to bein odom l'chavera, when it comes to interpersonal relationships. Let's be a little machmir. So we'll go a little bit more than is required. We'll estimate a little bit more than we think. We'll be on the safe side. Nothing terrible will happen. That's not how we make our money in any case. We don't make our money from overcharging and underbuying. We make our money from working. So who cares if we're overpaying a cent or two? Or if when we're selling we're being underpaid a cent or two? That's not what's critical. What's critical is that it's fair, and what's critical is that in the questions of chesed, of dealing in chesed, that we go out of our way to overpay, and we go out of our way to undersell, because of the embarrassment that we feel at any stage, chas v'sholem, of finding ourselves having taken out of this world more than we've put in, of having received from somebody more than we've given them, of having benefited from others more than they've benefited from us.